it, and of course her past is checkered. But it takes a great deal of courage to reform one's character, and I am gratified by the effort she has made. She has thrown off her dependency for a start, and she is determined never to sell her body again. For those things, I commend her. What is your opinion of her mental state? Oh, she is perfectly sane, said Devlin, blinking. I have no doubt about that. Thank you, Reverend, Moody said, and then to the Justice, thank you, sir. Next came the expert testimonies from Dr. Gillies. A Dr. Sanders called down from Kumara to deliver a second medical opinion upon Anna's mental state, and a Mr. Walsham, police inspector from the Greymouth Police. The plaintiff, George Shepherd, was the last to be called. As Moody had expected, Shepherd dwelled long upon Anna Wetherill's poor character, citing her opium dependency, her unsavoury profession, and her former suicide attempt as proof of her ignominy. He detailed the ways in which her behaviour had wasted police resources and offended the standards of moral decency, and recommended strongly that she be committed to the newly built asylum at Sea View. But Moody had planned his defence well. Following the revelation about Ah Suk and Devlin's testimony, Shepherd's admonitions came off as rancorous, even petty. Moody congratulated himself silently for raising the issue of Anna's lunacy before the plaintiff had a chance. When at last Broom sat down, the justice peered down at the barrister's bench and said,
"Your witness, Mr. Moody."
"Thank you, sir," said Moody. He turned to the jailer. "Governor Shepherd, to your eye, is the signature of Emery Staines upon this deed of gift a demonstrable forgery?" Shepherd lifted his chin.
"I'd call it a near enough replica."
"Pardon me, sir, why near enough?" Shepherd looked annoyed.
"It is a good replica," he amended.
"Might one call it an exact replica of Mr. Staines' signature?"
"That's for the experts to say," said Shepherd, shrugging. "I am not an expert in specialized fraud."
"Governor Shepherd," said Moody, "have you been able to detect any difference whatsoever between this signature and other documents signed by Mr. Staines, of which the Reserve Bank has an extensive and verifiable supply?"
"No, I have not," said Shepherd.
"Upon what evidence do you base your claim that the signature is in fact a forgery?"
"I had seen the deed in question in February, and at that point it was unsigned," said Shepherd. "Miss Wetherill brought the same document into the courthouse on the afternoon of the 20th of March, and it was signed. There are only two explanations. Either she forged the signature herself, which I believe to be the case, or she was in collusion with Mr. Staines during his period of absence, and in that case she has perjured in a court of law."
"In fact, there is a third explanation," Moody said. "If indeed that signature is a forgery, as you so vehemently attest it is, then somebody other than Anna might have signed it. Somebody who knew that document was in the chaplain's possession, and who desired very much, for whatever reason, to see Miss Wetherill indicted." Shepherd's expression was cold.
"I resent your implication, Mr. Moody."
Moody reached into his wallet and produced a small slip of paper. "I have here," he said, "a promissory note dated June of last year, submitted by Mr. Richard Mannering, which bears Miss Wetherill's own mark. Do you notice anything about Miss Wetherill's signature, Governor?" Shepherd examined the note.
"She signed with an X," he said at last.
"Precisely. She signed with an X," Moody said. "If Miss Wetherill can't even sign her own name, Governor Shepherd, what on earth makes you think that she can produce a perfect replica of someone else's?"
All eyes were on Shepherd. He was still looking at the promissory note.
"Thank you, sir," said Moody to the justice. I have no further questions.
All right, Mr. Moody, said the justice, in a voice that might have conveyed either amusement or disapproval. You may step down.
Venus is a morning star, in which a temptation presents itself under a guise. Once the Fortunate Wind reached her mooring at Port Chalmers, and the gangways were lowered to the docks, Anna was obliged to join the women's queue in order to be inspected by the medical officials. From the quarantine shelter she went on to the custom house to have her entry papers stamped and approved. After these interviews were completed, she was directed to the depot to see about picking up her trunk. It was a very small one, barely larger than a hat box. She could almost hold it beneath one arm. And there she met with a further delay, her trunk having been loaded onto another lady's carriage by mistake. By the time this error was corrected and her luggage recovered, it was well past noon. Emerging from the depot at last, Anna looked about hopefully for the golden-haired boy who had so delighted her upon the deck that morning, but she saw nobody she recognized. Her fellow passengers had long since dispersed into the crush of the city. She set her trunk down on the quay and took a moment to straighten her gloves.
"Excuse me, miss," came a voice approaching, and Anna turned. The speaker was a copper-haired woman, plump and smooth-complexioned. She was very finely dressed in a gown of green brocade. "Excuse me," she said again, "but are you by any chance newly arrived in town?"
"Yes, ma'am," said Anna. "I arrived just now, this morning."
"On which vessel, please?"
"The Fortunate Wind, ma'am."
"Yes," said the woman. "Yes. Well, in that case, perhaps you can help me. I'm waiting for a young woman named Elizabeth Mackay. She's around your age, plain, slim, dressed like a governess, travelling alone."
"I'm afraid I haven't seen her," said Anna.
"She will be 19 this August," the woman went on. "She's my cousin's cousin. I've never met her before, but by all accounts she's very well kept and moderately pretty. Elizabeth Mackay is her name. You haven't seen her?"
"I'm very sorry, ma'am."
"What was the name of your ship?"
"The Fort..."